Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements with black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit won't be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prisons. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
In the name of their European masters. So then when I talk about black upon black violence in this book, or we talk about the young men and women in the U.S. Army today, recognize then that we are talking about nothing new, but something that is continuous with the very essence and nature of imperialism and racism. Recognize also that when we talk about black on black violence, we are talking about a violence that violence produced. That black upon black violence is reflective of white on black violence. And that ultimately it reflects the violence that this Eurocentric and European community has practiced upon black people and our reactions to that violence. When we then talk about a racist society, an imperialistic society, Recognize then that we are talking about a crimogenic society. What do we mean by crimogenic society? Of course, racism is a crime against humanity and a crime against our race. Imperialism is a crime against our race as well. And therefore, when you have a racist society and an imperialistic society, you have a crimogenic society. What do we mean then by a crimogenic society? Of course, dealing with the word genesis, we are talking about the idea of generating the beginning, as in the word genesis, to begin, the source of, the point of creation of. So when we talk about this society as a crimogenic society, we are talking about this society then as the source of crimes, as the generator of criminality, as the creator of criminals, a society that is run by criminals, and a society then that ultimately criminalizes its population and criminalizes the total system. I had a piece here, you know, there's some of you here who are middle class and you think you're nice. You think you're non-criminal. A criminal society criminalizes all of its constituents. And I don't have time tonight to read to you the justification for that piece. Oh, there's some of you who've been in the church and you think you're good. Read in Black on Black Violence where I talk about your dumb goodness. A goodness that maintains sin and criminality. We don't have time to talk about it tonight. You're in the church, but you're guilty too. Because you see, ladies and gentlemen, when the leadership of a nation lies to that nation, when it deceives that nation, when it miseducates that nation and falsifies facts, it falsifies the consciousness of the people who inhabit that nation. And when it falsifies their consciousness, it recruits those of its people into its criminality. So whether you know it or don't know it, you're a part of the game. Oh yes, we have to confront our responsibility for this criminal situation as well. Yes, we do. Whether you're looking at us as so-called middle class, remember those of you who are making it in this society, who are making great profits, great accomplishments, sitting at the same tables with your white masters. That you're sitting and profiting from the death and murder and destruction of your ancestors. That as you eat with your white masters, you are eating the flesh and spirits of your people. You can cover it up and lie to yourself and claim it's your individual striving that got you where you're going. That you are taking advantage of opportunity. But remember, these opportunities were based on the death and destruction of African people and the continuing death and destruction of African people. Those of you rolling around in the church and carrying on in the same position as well. But let me continue. This society is a society of criminals, run by criminals, and it is a creator of criminals. And we must recognize it. And I have to say that because we've got some people out here who say, I want my children to be just like them. That's the ultimate goal. I don't want there to be any differences. What are you talking about? You want them to be enslavers, rapists, and robbers, and killers, and murderers, and imperialists, and so forth, just like the other folk, right? Think again, ladies and gentlemen. But due to our time, I'm just going to have to rush through here. I accuse the society of being a crimogenic society, a criminal society, a society that engages in white on black violence for a number of reasons. And of course, as you can tell, often the psychology of an individual or people in terms of their origins and early childhood experiences, you can look at then the psychology of a people in terms of their origins and early childhood of their race. And when we look then at the origins of this society, we must immediately recognize that it is a society founded on criminal activities. Yes, and that is its inheritance today. It is still a part of it. A society that is a crimogenic society and a society that engages on black violence because it is founded on the murder and theft of Indian peoples and Indian lands. It is a crimogenic society, a criminal society, and a society that practices white on black violence because it is a society founded on the kidnapping of African people, the manslaughter of African people in the mid-passage, the extortion from African people of their labor, and the enslavement of African people. Therefore, the very nature and foundations of this society rest on two massive genocidal crimes, and this original crime is a part of its nature today. It is a crimogenic society because this group of people cannot face their own criminality. They must engage in the psychology of denial and repression and distortion. And this denial and distortion and repression must suffuse throughout the total society, throughout its total institutions, throughout its total values, and therefore ultimately it must pervert its total population. It is a criminal society and a white-on-black violent society because it engages in the crime of breach of contract. It has breached the contract of its constitution. It breached the contracts it made with African people during the reconstructions. It breached its contracts of the 14th, 15th, and other amendments. It breached its contracts in reversing its rulings in the 1860s, 1870s, 1980s, and 1990s. It breached its contracts in terms of sharecropping, the peonage of our people, going back on the 40 acres and a mule, and all the rest of the things. It is a criminal society because it constantly engages in assault and battery against its black populations. It engaged in historical lynching, and behind the walls, as my brother mentioned here, of prisons, it still now engages in legal lynchings of African people. It engages in Klan terrorism, which it is still engaged in today. It engages in race riots where it destroys the African people. It engages in police riots, and it engages in police brutality where over 300 or more of our young men and women have been destroyed in the city of New York alone. It is a criminal society, and it is a crimogenic society, and a society that engages in white-on-black violence because it is indicted on the charges of official malfeasance when it revokes its mandate in terms of giving justice to its people and makes its justice system an instrument of injustice when its so-called rehabilitative system is a school for criminality. It engages in official malfeasance when it rigs its juries, when it legally lynches the ones it so woefully sentences. It engages in official malfeasance when it engages in gerrymandering of black districts, when it betrays the mandates of black voters, when it builds, as my brother mentioned here, prisons as industries, so that the incarceration of black men becomes a profit-making industry and a means by which the ruling class makes war against the subordinate classes. It engages in criminal activity, and it is a criminal society when it engages in unfair labor practices, job discrimination, when at the end of the Reconstruction there were more black skilled workers than there were whites, and the whites unionized to keep the blacks from taking advantage of the opportunities that were available to them. It is indicted for labor racketeering when it runs black men away from its construction sites, when we go into a black community where housing is supposedly being made and built for black residents, and we see few, if any, black men building those houses. And when those black men come to work on those sites, they are chased away by the police and the construction workers. And when they are chased away and made to stand on the corners, then they are accused of refusing to work and desiring not to work. We accuse this society of being a crimogenic society, of being a criminal organization, of being an organization that engages in chronic white-on-black violence, when it engages in drug trafficking, when it imports the drugs that poisons our neighborhoods and destroys the consciousness of our people, destroys their health. We see a criminogenic people from way back engaging in the selling of opium to the Chinese and in engaging in opium wars. We see this drug trafficking group of people engaging in alcohol addiction when they used it to destroy Indians, when they used it to destroy African chiefs who, under the influence of the alcohol, often signed away their peoples and their nations. We accuse it of drug addiction and drug trafficking when it traded guns for drugs to carry on its warfare in Central and South America. We accuse it of being a criminal nation, a crimogenic society, when it engages in gun running across the world, when it sells the very weapons that will be used to destroy its own sons and daughters. We accuse it of criminality when it acts to maintain an evil military-industrial complex. We accuse it of being a criminal society when it sells its death wares across the world. How many of us recognize that we are dealing here with merchants of death? That these people are dead and deadly. People who are robbing black people at home so that they can rob black people abroad. We accuse this nation of being a crimogenic society and the ruling white population of being a criminal people because they engage in economic extortion, taxation of black people without representation, the redlining of black communities as they steal the savings an investment of black people, as they disinvest in the black community, as they do not return loans to the black community, and use the monies that the black communities and the black church place in their coffers to export jobs out of the community into suburbs beyond the black, to the reach of the black population. When they export jobs outside of the country totally and starve our black men and women in Detroit and the other urban centers of this world, we accuse them of economic extortion when they deindustrialize this nation and ship out the blue-collar jobs that maintain the families of black people across this country and ship them to other places and exploit the other populations of this world. We accuse them of imperial criminality and of organized crime. This nation is an organized mafia operation. I have indicated to you that it is best when you look at the international situation that you will come away with a better understanding if you apply the concepts of mafia psychology to the international relations that are going on right now and that have been going on. We don't have time to talk about a chapter I do in here that I call Quantifying the Myth. You know, the myth of making black people appear to be more criminal than white people. A myth that is statistically supported by the number of black men and women arrested, by the number of black men and women incarcerated, by the number of black men and women under probation and parole. And of course, now we are supposed to look at those statistics and compare them between black and white. And because we see more blacks arrested, more blacks in jail, more blacks in probation and parole, we are supposed to make the illogical assumption that blacks are more criminal than whites. I told you time and time again, ladies and gentlemen, that in a society that's based on lies, as this one is, in a society that can only exist based on deception, that truth is reversed. That's in essence what a lie is. And therefore, when you look at the so-called statistics that seek to establish the criminality of black people, turn it around and turn them around, and you will recognize that the criminals are outside the prisons. We don't have time to talk about it tonight, but that's the value of having power, you see. You can make criminal whatever you want to make it. You can legitimize your own criminality and perverseness. You can call virtue a crime and arrest people for being virtuous. And then you can look at the statistics and say, aren't they more criminal because they are in jail? Some of you read the recent situation here in the Hasidic community where a bunch of Jews ran out, broke arms, and hurt the police, but about 2 or 3 dozen policemen. This, of course, comes after a time when they broke into a police precinct station and ransacked it. How many of those people went to jail? How many got fingerprinted? How many of them are in prison? And so forth. And yet, can we say that they did not commit a crime? You see, what do we have here then? A situation, you see, where if you use crime statistics, you're not going to find those Hasidic Jews in the statistics. You're not going to find them on the prison rolls. You see, that's what power does for you, isn't it? It permits you to commit a crime and keep yourself out of jail. And then you can go into the jailhouse and look at the statistics and compare the number of blacks arrested on probation, on parole, and compare them with Hasidic Jews. And say, well, I see one is very big and the other one is very little. Therefore, the blacks must be more criminal than the Hasidic Jews. You can never be more wrong in your life. You have to understand, but we have to get away from that. You know, and this is the kind of teaching that goes on in the university today. Understand that when white boys and white girls are not on the rolls, the prison rolls, and in the prison populations, it points to the efficiency of their criminal organization. How do we say that? A mafia don who has a very efficient criminal operation, who can create a murder incorporated, who can engage in drug trafficking and killing and murdering and extortion, the same kind of games I've been reading to you here tonight, can earn so much money until he can keep his children innocent, keep them out of jail, give them good educations, and the whole bit. You understand what I'm getting at? In other words, those children's names do not appear on the crime blotters. They are not in the jails because their fathers are such good mafia operators. So even their innocence speaks to the efficient criminality of their fathers. And because then the white boys are not in jail with the black boys, do not make the assumption that means the white boys are less criminal or their fathers are less criminal. It means they just have a criminally efficient operation. We got to move on here. This country then is an imperialist criminal operation because it robs the people at home, and you see it as it robs the people abroad. It constricts the black males to fight its criminal wars. It maintains worldwide terror and extortion. It, of course, maintains the criminality in Namibia, South Africa, Angola, Panama, Grenada, Central South America, Zaire, and the whole bit. I accuse this nation of being a criminal nation because it engages in the health neglect of our people. This nation, as determined by its own task force, indicates that black and minority health, in the area of black and minority health, there are 60,000 more minority deaths per year based on an expectation of equal death rates for blacks and whites. As a matter of fact, melanin gives you an added lifespan. So what are we saying here? That this society, due to its neglect of the health of black people, excesses the lives of some 60,000 black people a year. This is murder. It engages in child neglect and child abuse as it maintains the infant mortality rate of black children to more than twice that of white children, as it maintains a measles rate 16 times that of white children, as it maintains the poverty of our black children, increasing the poverty of black children at the rate of some 750,000 children a year. It engages in educational neglect, as it engages in the miseducation of our children, as it refuses to fund the Head Start and early childhood education programs, as it refuses to fund the education programs under Chapter 1. And I wish I had the time to read the statistics here of how our children are killed and our families are destroyed through educational neglect. This criminal society then sets up the psychology of black-on-black violence by creating a sense of powerlessness in our young people, by projecting negative stereotypes upon their mentality such that they seek to escape an African identity and alienate themselves from their African selves. and internalize the values and perceptions projected by the dominant society as their appetites are distorted so that they literally then eat themselves to death or desire things which will destroy them as it frustrates them such that in their anger they turn against themselves, as it makes them displace their anger against their fellow victims. This society is a criminogenic society because it serves as the best model of criminality. The black-on-black criminal has learned from the best of teachers, the white-on-black criminal. It engages in criminality as it supplies weaponry to our children and alcohol and drugs. How does this relate then to our adolescents? Recognize that almost 50% of the young men who die between 15 and 24 die as a result of homicide, black-on-black homicide. This would be a major health problem if we were another ethnic group. Recognize that the cream of the African race is being destroyed before it has a chance to reach manhood. Homicide is the leading cause of death of black males between 15 and 24. Is it because, ladies and gentlemen, if you look at the demographic situations in this country, we are producing and outproducing white people in terms of children? Must understand that at a rate of almost 3 or 4 to 1. The Hispanics are outproducing them about 5 or 6 to 1. That means the larger part of the up-and-coming population is going to be black and Latino. And these people have already written about the birth dearth. And so what do we have here then, ladies and gentlemen? The destruction of a race and the destruction of that group that would move us toward being a majority in this country. So this has a lot to do with adolescence, and adolescence, of course, is a major point in the development of an individual's life, because it is during adolescence that the self-concept is being developed, that the individual is undergoing an identity crisis, a gender identity crisis, that the individual is dealing with the issues of self-esteem, dealing with the issues of body image, which is the reason why you see them getting caught up in clothes and other adornments. It is the period of time when an individual looks for social affirmation and social acceptance and looks forward to social belongingness. It is a period of time when the emotions are labile and unstable, and therefore the individual is seeking to bring his emotional, sexual, and other drives under control. It is a period of time when the individual is wrestling with social acceptance, wrestling with alienation from the adult society, the society in general, and alienation from itself. It is the time when the person is engaged in intellectual development. It is a time when the individual is asking and trying to deal with moral questions and make vocational choices. It is a time of egocentrism, a time of status striving and being concerned with clothing and cars and other things. It is a time when the person deals with invidious comparisons. That is, how do I make myself look good by making other people look bad? And therefore, when you look at this social system, it strikes our youngsters at their most vulnerable periods of their lives and seeks to transform them. Now, you may say, some of you who are older, well, you know, we wrestled with the same thing. But keep this in mind, you see, that though these issues are issues that may have been a part of my generation and earlier generations, that these issues are taking place within a different social political context. They're taking place within a different socioeconomic historical context. And it is these contexts that combine to determine whether these issues will develop into positive outcomes, negative outcomes, or conflicting and ambivalent outcomes. So today's black adolescents, particularly the poverty-stricken adolescents, exist in a world that is quite different from the world of his parents. Very different from the world even of the 50s and 60s, because we have a youth now that is engaged in the post-industrial age. When you dropped out of school, there were jobs waiting in some factory or on some shipyard or some other place for you. Those jobs are not there today. And so you have to recognize that these youngsters are dealing with a different world. The computers weren't there when you dropped out at the time and when you miseducated yourself. These are children who are, who are engaged in an information age. These are children who are engaged in a highly urbanized world. These are no longer farm boys and rural people from the rural South caught up in their rural communities. These are kids raised in the ghettos, in the projects, and in the poverty-stricken areas of the urban cities. These are children then that are raised in an information data processing world, a world of television and mass media, a mass media that recognizes that they have money or that they can get money. And now a world that instead of just selling to adults makes teenagers its major marketing audience and therefore creates desires and wishes and plays the cruel hoax on our teenagers by provoking their desires through TV, through singers, through Ray Charles talking about Pepsi, to black religious music, and then does not provide them the means by which they are to get the thing by which their appetites have been provoked to desire. Recognize this then, ladies and gentlemen. Recognize that we are dealing at a time of rising expectations. You see, when we grew up, we knew that there were certain slots for us, and we didn't have to worry about the other ones. Now we live in a world of rising expectations. Be the best that you can be. Be all that you can be. We see the result of that. These youngsters are living in a time of family dissolution. Remember, the largest percentage of black children up to the 1950s were raised in a two-headed family. Now we are dealing with children where the vast majority of families are single-headed and in poverty and caught in their situations. So don't be too quick to put yourself in this place and compare yourself in your time to the children in this time. You're dealing with a different time. We're dealing in a time of conservative governments and a conservative world situation. We are dealing in a time of world and national demographic changes. These children are growing up in a time, as we said earlier, where there's an availability of weapons so that they may kill themselves, where the escapist drugs have moved beyond alcohol and twister wine and moved into devastating crack, and a type of drug now that didn't involve hustling 50 Cent to get a bit of Thunderbird, but that now must involve constant hustling, robbery, and even death to get a whiff of crack. A type of drug situation and an escapist drug situation that creates a totally different social structure, a totally different attitudinal structure, such being that the black community is held in terror and families are being destroyed and robbed by their own sons and daughters. Recommendations. We have to go quickly here, but I'm going to get it in. You'll have to catch me at another time. Yet, and we had to, but I've got to mention the recommendations at least, because we have to move beyond analysis. So let me quickly just run through these. Pardon me if I'm going fast here. If this is a crimogenic society, and it is, then we recognize that that's the people that our major problem is not being left out of the American mainstream and being left out of the system. We must recognize that we cannot join a criminal system because we will become criminals in it. Colin Powell represents the apotheosis, the ultimate of what a criminal system is. He represents what it means to move up in a criminal society. In moving into that system and becoming integrated in it and assimilated with it, he must now become allied with this criminality. And if that system then is dependent upon the death and damnation of black people, upon the imperial subordination of black people, then those like Colin Powell that move up in this system must also then engage in the death and damnation of black people as well. We have to keep that in mind. You're not moving up into this system as it is unless you're also moving against the interests of black people. And therefore, you have to recognize that the goal of our people in this crimogenic society is to change the very nature of the social system, to tear it apart and to reconstruct it, to bring into being that word that Bush stole from us, a new world order. Our mission is much higher than assimilating into this system. It must be to create a new world. If this climagenic society creates a sense of powerlessness in our children, then we must, as a people, develop and use our power. We must take power and train our youth for taking and expressing power positively. If this system destroys the attitudes of our people through projection and projecting on them criminality, we must inoculate our children against evil white projections by inoculating them with truth and the truth of themselves, inoculating them with self-knowledge. We must inoculate them against projection and the internalization of negative attitudes by getting them into the knowledge and the psychology and the ways of their white enemies, and getting them to have an efficient perception of reality and remove their deceptions. If they are alienated from themselves and are infused by an evil white spirit who is implanted in their minds and bodies to serve the will of his devilish masters, then we must reclaim our African-centered identity, and we must reclaim an African-centered consciousness, and we must learn to love ourselves and love each other and engage in cooperation and communalism. This is how we prevent alienation. If the society twists our desires and makes us desire the things that destroy us and hate the things that advance our interests, we must learn a new set of values, inculcate deep and abiding cultural goals, learn to discern when one is being manipulated and exploited. Our children must learn the mechanisms of advertising, mass hypnosis, subliminal suggestion, conditioning, and lies and propaganda. They must learn to be productive so that they can produce for their own desires. They must learn to assume the ownership of the means of production and learn self-control. If the society moves our children into black-on-black violence because it engages them in frustration and the dealing with their frustrations in incorrect ways, then we must train our children to be task-oriented, to solve the causes of problems and not engage in dealing with the symptoms of problems. We must teach them to discern the sources of their frustration and remove those sources and tear them out from the root. We must teach them how to use their anger and aggressive feelings positively. Every emotion that is in the human mind is there for a positive reason, and they must be used for positive reasons. Anger is a positive emotion if it is used correctly. So is aggression. God did not put anger and aggression in you just for negative purposes alone, but we must be taught how to use those things. We must teach them to be resourceful and how to get around those frustrations, to develop social intelligence, skills, and competence. We must teach them coping strategies for stress. If they displace their anger and use their anger to attack themselves and destroy themselves and to destroy others like themselves, we must get them to know their real enemy. We must get them to recognize that this enemy, this white man, is only a man, that he bleeds and dies like any other man.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to have just an off-the-cuff chat between you and me, us. We want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand. We all agree tonight, all of the speakers have agreed, that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is us. We're her problem. The only reason she has a problem is she doesn't want us here. And every time you look at yourself, be you black, brown, red, or yellow, a so-called Negro, you represent a person who poses such a serious problem for America because you're not wanted. Once you face this as a fact, then you can start plotting a course that will make you appear intelligent instead of unintelligent. What you and I need to do is learn to forget our differences. Right. When we come together, we don't come together as Baptists or Methodists. You don't catch hell because you're a Baptist, and you don't catch hell because you're a Methodist. You don't catch hell because you're a Methodist or a Baptist. You don't catch hell because you're a Democrat or a Republican. You don't catch hell because you're a Mason or an Elk. And you sure don't catch hell because you're an American, because if you was an American, you wouldn't catch no hell. You catch hell because you're a black man. You catch hell, all of us catch hell for the same reason. So we are all black people, so-called Negroes, second-class citizens, ex-slaves. You are nothing but an ex-slave. You don't like to be told that. But what else are you? You are ex-slave. You didn't come here on the Mayflower. You came here in a slave ship, in chains, like a horse or a cow or a chicken. And you were brought here by the people who came here on the Mayflower. You were brought here by the so-called pilgrims or founding fathers. They were the ones who brought you here. We have a common enemy. We have this in common. We have a common oppressor, a common exploiter, and a common discriminator. So once we all realize that we have this common enemy, then we unite on the basis of what we have in common. And what we have foremost in common is that enemy, the white man. He's an enemy to all of us. I know some of you all think that some of them aren't enemies. Time will tell. In Bandung, back in, I think, 1954, was the first unity meeting in centuries of black people. And once you study what happened at the Bandung Conference and the results of the Bandung Conference, it actually serves as a model for the same procedure you and I can use to get our problem solved. At Bandung, all the nations came together. They were dark nations from Africa and Asia. Some of them were Buddhists. Some of them were Muslim. Some of them were Christian. Some of them were Confucianists. Some were atheists. Despite their religious differences, they came together. Some were communists. Some were socialists. Some were capitalists. Despite their economic and political differences, they came together. All of them were black, brown, red, or yellow. The number one thing that was not allowed to attend the Bandung Conference was the white man. He couldn't come. Once they excluded the white man, they found that they could get together. Once they kept him out, everybody else fell right in and fell in line. This is the thing that you and I have to understand. And these people who came together didn't have nuclear weapons. They didn't have jet planes. They didn't have all of the heavy armaments that the white man has, but they had unity. They were able to submerge their little petty differences and agree on one thing, that though one African came from Kenya and was being colonized by the Englishmen, and another African came from the Congo and was being colonized by the Belgian, and another African came from Guinea and was being colonized by the French, and another came from Angola and was being colonized by the Portuguese. When they came to the Bandung Conference, they looked at the Portuguese and at the Frenchmen and at the Englishmen and at the other Dutchmen and learn or realize that the one thing that all of them had in common, they were all from Europe. They were all Europeans, blonde, blue-eyed, and white-skinned.
They began to recognize who their enemy was. The same man that was colonizing our people in Kenya was colonizing our people in the Congo. The same one in the Congo was colonizing our people in South Africa and in southern Rhodesia and in Burma and in India and in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. They realized all over the world where a dark man was being oppressed, he was being oppressed by the white man. Where the dark man was being exploited, he was being exploited by the white man. So they got together under this basis, that they had a common enemy. And when you and I here in Detroit and in Michigan and in America, who have been awakened today, look around us, we too realize here in America, we all have a common enemy. Whether he's in Georgia or Michigan, whether he's in California or New York, he's the same man. Blue eyes and blonde hair and pale skin. Same man. So what we have to do is what they did. They agreed to stop quarreling among themselves. Any little spat that they had, they'd settle it among themselves. Go into a huddle. Don't let the enemy know that you got a disagreement. Instead of us airing our differences in public, we have to realize we're all the same family. And when you have a family squabble, you don't get out on the sidewalk. If you do, everybody calls you uncouth, unrefined, uncivilized, savage. If you don't make it at home, you settle it at home. You get in the closet. Argue it out behind closed doors. And then when you come out on the street, you pose a common front, a united front. And this is what we need to do in the community and in the city and in the state. We need to stop airing our differences in front of the white man. Put the white man out of our meeting, number one. And then sit down and talk shop with each other. That's all you got to do. I would like to make a few comments concerning the difference between the black revolution and the Negro revolution. There's a difference. Are they both the same? And if they're not, what is the difference? What is the difference between a black revolution and a Negro revolution? First, what is a revolution? Sometimes I'm inclined to believe that many of our people are using this word revolution loosely without taking careful consideration what this word actually means and what its historic characteristics are. When you study the historic nature of revolution, the motive of a revolution, the objective of a revolution, and the result of a revolution, and the methods used in a revolution, you may change words. You may devise another program. You may change your goal and you may change your mind. Look at the American Revolution in 1776. That revolution was for what? For land. How was it? Why did they want land? Independence. How was it carried out? Bloodshed. Number one, it was based on land. The basis of independence. And the only way they could get it was bloodshed. The French Revolution, what was it based on? The landless against the landlord. What was it for? Land. How did they get it? Bloodshed. Was no love lost. Was no compromise. Was no negotiation. I'm telling you, you don't know what a revolution is. Because when you find out what it is, you'll get back in the alley. You'll get out of the way. just a moment. The Russian Revolution. What was it based on? Land. The landless against the landlord. How did they bring it about? Bloodshed. You haven't got a revolution that doesn't involve bloodshed. And you're afraid to bleed. I said you're afraid to bleed. Long as the white man sent you to Korea, you bled. He sent you to Germany, you bled. He sent you to the South Pacific to fight the Japanese, you bled. You bleed for white people. But when it comes time to seeing your own churches being bombed and little black girls murdered, you haven't got no blood. You bleed when the white man says bleed. You bite when the white man says bite. And you bark when the white man says bark. I hate to say this about us, but it's true. How you gonna be nonviolent in Mississippi as violent as you were in Korea? How can you justify being nonviolent in Mississippi and Alabama when your churches are being bombed and your little girls are being murdered? And at the same time, you're going to get violent with Hitler and Tojo and somebody else that you don't even know. If violence is wrong in America, violence is wrong abroad. If it's wrong to be violent, defending black women and black children and black babies and black men, then it's wrong for America to draft us and make us violent abroad in defense of her. The Chinese Revolution. They wanted land. They threw the British out, along with the Uncle Tom Chinese. Yeah, they did. They set a good example. When I was in prison, I read an article, and don't be shocked when I say I was in prison. You're still in prison. That's what America means, prison. When I was in prison, I read an article in Life magazine showing a little Chinese girl, 9 years old, her father was on his hands and knees, and she was pulling the trigger because he was an Uncle Tom Chinaman. Yeah. When they had the revolution over there, they took a whole generation of Uncle Toms,
right,
just wiped them out.
Yeah, right.
And within 10 years, that little girl became a full-grown woman. No more Toms in China. And today is one of the toughest, roughest, most feared countries on this earth by the white man because there are no Uncle Toms over there. Of all our studies, history is best qualified to reward all research. And when you see that you got problems, all you have to do is examine the historic method used all over the world by others who had problems similar to yours. And once you see how they got theirs straight, then you know how you can get yours straight. There's been a revolution, a black revolution, going on in Africa. In Kenya, the Mau Mau were revolutionaries. They were the ones who made the word Uhuru. They were the ones who brought it to the fore. The Mau Mau, they were revolutionaries. They believed in scorched earth. They knocked everything aside that got in their path. And their revolution also was based on land, a desire for land. In Algeria, the northern part of Africa, a revolution took place. The Algerians were revolutionaries. They wanted land. France offered to let them be integrated into France. They told France to hell with France. They wanted some land, not some France. and they engaged in a bloody battle. So I cite these various revolutions, brothers and sisters, to show you, you don't have a peaceful revolution. You don't have a turn the other cheek revolution. There's no such thing as a nonviolent revolution. Only kind of revolution that's nonviolent is the Negro Revolution. The only revolution based on loving your enemy is the Negro Revolution. The only revolution in which the goal is a desegregated lunch counter, a desegregated theater, a desegregated park, and a desegregated public toilet. You can sit down next to white folks on the toilet. That's no revolution. Revolution is based on land. Land is the basis of all independence. Land is the basis of freedom, justice, and equality. The white man knows what a revolution is. He knows that the black revolution is worldwide in scope and in nature. The black revolution is sweeping Asia, sweeping Africa. It's rearing its head in Latin America. The Cuban Revolution, that's a revolution. They overturned the system. Revolution is in Asia. Revolution is in Africa. And the white man is screaming because he sees revolution in Latin America. How do you think he'll react to you when you learn what a real revolution is? You don't know what a revolution is. If you did, you wouldn't use that word. A revolution is bloody. Revolution is hostile. Revolution knows no compromise. Revolution overturns and destroys everything that gets in its way. And you sitting around here like a knot on these folks, no matter how much they hate me. No, you need a revolution. Ever heard of a revolution where they lock arms, as Reverend Klieg was pointing out beautifully, singing "We Shall Overcome"? Just tell me you don't do that in a revolution. You don't do any singing. You're too busy swinging.
Welcome you to our rally, our unity rally, for a united black front, to unite all factions of our people, to unite every one of the 20 million so-called Negroes into one group. And you'll notice, whenever the white man thinks that we're going to call a rally to knock our own kind, you see him jammed out here. He wants to hear us say something against King or against Bunch or against Farmer, against someone of our own kind. He jams out here. But when you call a rally for black people to unite, let's get together, you don't see too many white folks then. They don't like black people to get together in unity and harmony. As long as you and I are going to attack each other or talk about each other or he scorn and ridicule upon each other, the white man gets his kick. But when he knows that we're going to come together in unity and harmony, he won't get his kick, he will get kicked. When you see you and I getting together, it is because we have begun to realize that we have a common enemy. And the only time we'll be able to come together with a common objective and a common goal is when we first develop a common motive. And that motive is best developed by recognizing the common enemy. And that common enemy is the white man. I say that common enemy is the white man. The white man is your enemy, whether you are a Baptist, whether you are a Methodist, whether you are an Episcopalian, or whether you're a Muslim, or whether you're a Mason, or whether you're an elf. If you find yourself running into opposition when you're looking for freedom, justice, and equality, or some kind of rights, you have to agree, always the one who opposes your right is the white man. Some old blue-eyed, blonde-haired, bad-smelling white man. He puts his club upside your head. He doesn't care whether you're a Baptist, a Methodist, but he does want to know whether or not you're a Muslim. Because he knows if you're a Baptist or a Methodist, you're going to turn the other cheek. You're going to try and love your enemy. You're going to pray for them that despitefully use you. So he's not worried about you. But he knows if you're a Muslim, you're not going to turn the other cheek. If you pray for him, you pray that God kills him, or God helps you to kill him. That's the only kind of prayer you pray. It's time for you and me to unite, to get together and get this big white ape off our back. You got a bad habit. You're hooked and don't know it. You got what's known as white disease. You think you can't get along without the white man. You think you can't get some clothes without the white man. You think you can't get a house without the white man. You think you can't even get a job without the white man. You're worse than a man who thinks he can't get along without heroin. You're worse than the man who thinks he can't get along without morphine. You're worse than the junkie. You're in worse shape than the junkie, because the junkie only has a little monkey on his back and you're running around with a big white ape named Uncle Sam on your back. America is faced with her worst domestic crisis since the Civil War, or since the Revolutionary War. For America now faces a race war. A race war is worse than a Revolutionary War. A race war is worse than a Civil War. A race war is a war in which no holds are barred. A race war is a war in which children are destroyed, in which children are mutilated, in which children face the same destructive wrath that grown-ups face. A race war is the worst war that you can conceive. And this war, race war, that is coming upon the head of the white man is something that he is bringing down upon himself. The entire country is on the verge of erupting into racial violence and bloodshed. Simply because 20 million ex-slaves are demanding freedom, justice, and equality here in America from their former slave master. 20 million so-called Negroes, second-class citizens, seeking human dignity, seeking human rights, seeking the right to live in dignity as a human being. And rather than give genuine respect and recognition to your cry for human rights, the American white man answers your nonviolence with violence. He answers your prayers and your freedom songs with false promises, deceitful maneuvers, and outright bloodshed. According to what we are taught from the white man's textbooks and his school, the Revolutionary War and the Civil War were two wars fought on American soil, supposedly for freedom and democracy. But if these two wars were really for the freedom and human dignity of all men, why are 20 million of our people still confined here in America and enslaved by second-class citizenship? Something is wrong. The truth is that the Revolutionary War was fought on American soil to free the American white man from the English white man. The Revolutionary War was never fought to provide freedom and democracy in this white country for the black man. Our people remain slaves here in America even after the Declaration of Independence was signed. In fact, most of the white founding fathers who signed the Declaration of Independence were nothing but slave owners themselves. It is sheer hypocrisy, sheer ignorance, sheer insanity for our people here in America to celebrate the 4th of July as Independence Day, while white America still denies us first-class citizenship that goes with an independent people. And it is nothing but hypocrisy for the American white man to pretend that the Revolutionary War was truly a war of independence as long as 20 million black people here in America are denied the privileges of an independent people. Don't let the white man fool you. Don't let the white man smile at you and lull you to sleep. Behind that smile is a vicious heart. Behind those teeth is an animal-like beast who doesn't have it within him to want for you what he wants for himself and his own kind. Don't let that man fool you. When you look at that man, you're supposed to see him for exactly what he is. And if you want to know what he is, examine his deeds. Forget his words. He got a whole lot of pretty sounding words. Watch his deeds. His deeds are like the deeds of a snake, the deeds of a serpent, the deeds of a dragon, the deeds of a reptile, the deeds of a beast. Why, nothing but a race of beasts would take dogs and stick them on little black babies. Nothing but a race of beasts will stick dogs on black children and black women. Nothing but a race of beasts. And it is these deeds today that's causing the wrath of God to come down upon the head of the white man. And when you see him as he is and see how much hell he's catching, you're out of his mind to want to be with him. You're out of your mind to want to integrate with him. And you're really out of your mind if you take time to forgive him and ask God to have mercy on him. No, ask God to judge him. Ask God to do unto him as he has done unto you. He has caused your babies to suffer. Ask God to heap suffering upon his babies. He has caused your women to suffer. Ask God to heap suffering on his women. He has caused all of our people to suffer. You can't deny that. You may not like my saying it, but you can't deny it. Why, you got scars and knots on your head from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet. And every one of those scars is evidence against the American white man and his hidden inhumanity to man. The Civil War was also fought on this continent, not to free the black slave, as is commonly taught in the white man's schools, but the Civil War was actually fought to preserve the Union, preserve this country, keep it intact for white people. It wasn't fought to set you free. It wasn't fought to give you some kind of emancipation. It wasn't fought to make you a citizen. It wasn't fought to give you civil rights. It wasn't fought because they respected you and loved you as a human being. It was fought out of greed. It was fought out of selfishness. It was fought to keep this country intact for their own white selves. In essence, this only means that the American white man fought the Revolutionary War to get this country for himself. And he then fought the Civil War to keep this country intact for himself. And today, he will now fight a race war to keep from having to share this white country on an equal basis with anyone else but his white self, especially on an equal basis with his 20 million former slaves. So again I ask, where will all of these demonstrations end? And who dares to say that our people are not justified by demonstrating their resentment over the injustice and mistreatment that our people have suffered these 400 years at the hands of this cruel, inhuman American white man? We have nothing to lose but our chains. We have nothing to lose but the hell we experience every day living here in these rat-filled slums. You have to excuse me for being blunt speaking and frank talking. We don't care who likes it or not, as long as we know it's the truth. Much of what I say might sound bitter, but it's the truth. Much of what I say might sound like it's stirring up trouble, but it's the truth. Much of what I say might sound like it is hate, but it's the truth. And God has mentioned in the Bible, it's truth alone today that'll make you free. If you're afraid to tell the truth, why, you don't even deserve freedom. Just tell the truth. The best thing to put the white man to flight is truth.
He can't take the truth. He can't stand the truth. He doesn't like the truth, especially when you know the truth about him. The truth about how he got those blue eyes. And the truth about how he got that stringy dog-like hair. And the truth about how his skin became as pale and pallid and sickly as it is. When you know the truth about how he got the way he is, you can run him down the street with nothing but truth. You don't need any blade. You don't need any switchblade. All you need is the truth. They put you in jail for carrying a blade, but they can't put you in jail for telling the truth.
Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. They gave leadership to our foreparents and that leadership made them slaves. But we have decided to find a leadership of our own to make ourselves free men. Our great scholars haven't passed through the colleges, the universities have thrown away the blessed record. Babylon did it. Assyria did it. France under Napoleon did it. Germany under Prince von Bismarck did it. England under America under George Washington did it. Africa with 400 million black people can do it. If you cannot do it, if you are not prepared to do it, then you will die. You race of cowards. You race of imbeciles. You race of good for nothing. If you cannot do what other men have done, what other nations have done, what other races have done, then you have better die. Can we do it? We can do it. We shall do it. We have prayed to God for vision and for leadership. And he has given us our universal vision. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to America. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to the West Indies. But a vision that said it must be a free and redeemed Africa. Christ the crucified, Christ the despised. We appeal to you for help, for succor, for leadership. When you endeavor to carry your burden up the heights of Calvary. When white men spurned you. When white men scorned you, when white men spat upon you, when white men pierced your side out of which blood and water gushed forth, it was a black man in the name of Simon the Syrian who took your cross and bore it up the heights of Calvary. And now that we are bearing our burden of being so heavy, we just ask that you just help us on up the heights. Oh yes, the cause is grand, the cause is glorious. Surely we shall not turn back. Oh, sail on, sail on, sail on, oh mighty ship of state, sail on. Sail on until the flag of the red, the black, and the green is perched upon the hills of South Africa. Because the time has come for the black man to forget his hero worship of other races and to create and emulate heroes of his own. We must canonize our own saints, create our own martyrs, and elevate the positions of fame and honor black men and women who have made a distinct contribution to our racial history.
Looks like a doctor's signature to me.
Well, that's why I can't read it. Oh.
Guilty as charged. Dr. Dan Stock, 5777 West 700 North, McCordsville, Indiana.
We need more linear thinking at this point. Oh, yes. Does that mean that we forget the intuition? Not at all. Does that mean we forget the oral tradition? Not at all. But it means then that while maintaining those traditions, we also must enhance other aspects of our personality. We want to look a bit at culture. What is culture? And we should ask this again. I admire Chancellor Williams very much. And I think the destruction of black civilization, of course, was a magnificent book. And I've said many times, though I think many people read it incorrectly, they read it as history, which it really is not, per se. It is, as he stated very clearly, a set of case studies, an analysis of African culture with and of African history with the question in mind, in what way did these cultures or this history advance our interests in as a people, and in what way did this history fail us as a people as well? And we have to look at it that way. What were the problems represented by African cultures such that we permitted ourselves to be overrun by Europeans and we find ourselves in the situation that we find ourselves tonight? Understand? It's no insult for us to ask that question of ourselves. And it's no insult for us to look critically at African history and culture and to be critical of it. It is only through our being critical of our history and our culture that we can advance our interests as a people and survive as a people. Looking at the question, what is culture? Horton and Hunt said, from their life experiences, a group develops a set of rules and procedures for meeting their needs. The set of rules and procedures, together with a supporting set of ideas and values, is called a culture. To a great extent, you see, a culture involves a set of rules and a procedure for meeting needs. And this is the thing we have to keep in mind. You don't have a culture just to have a culture. And you don't claim a culture just because it's a culture or just because it's African. The ultimate thing that culture must do is solve problems. That's why people evolve a culture. That's why a culture comes into existence as a way of what? Solving problems and meeting needs. That's why, at a certain point, when a culture no longer meets the needs of a people or solves the problem confronting a people, that culture must be transformed. There's nothing sacred about holding a culture in the face of, you know, new events and new changes. Unless, of course, you're free to do that if you're willing also to accept suicide or death. And you have that right to that choice. You know, I tell people, you know, we have the right to say, look, we're going to hold on to this culture even if it kills us. But we should be what? Very conscious of our decision. We should not be holding on to it out of a misunderstanding of what culture is supposed to do. Ultimately, culture is supposed to solve problems and to meet the needs of the people. And a culture then has to be measured against those standards. Does this culture meet our needs? Does it solve our problems? Chancellor Weaver, in a sense, then looked at the African cultures, looked at African characteristics, and looked at them in terms of, in what way did they meet our needs, and in what way did they deal with the slave trade and colonialism and the other kind of things that happened to us as African people. And after going through that, then he set up what? The plan, which a lot of people don't read. Which is the whole point of what? It's the whole point of the book. Not the first part, but really the second part. Looking at our culture and our history critically, he then, and looking at our situation and where we are today as a result of that history and of those cultures, he then draws out a map for a plan, a way for us to what? Get out of our situation and to restore African civilization and to restore African people. But it's at that point most people sort of move on to something else. Mm-mm. This is the place you must study. We're going to include that in our power studies, by the way, that plan along with some others. The sets and rules and procedures together with a supporting set of ideas. Cultures are not just ways people sing and dance and what they eat and how they dress and the rituals and so forth that they perform. These ways of behaving and dressing and so forth are based on sets of ideas and values. And ultimately, in a deeper sense, it's this set of ideals and values that lay the basis for culture. Cluckhorn, an anthropologist, indicated that culture he defined culture as all the historically created designs for living, explicit and implicit, rational, irrational, and non-rational, which may exist at any given time as potential guides for the behavior of man, for the behavior of the people. In other words, culture creates designs as a result of its history for living and provides guides for its members, guides for behaving. As a set of the guides for designing, for guiding the behavior of its members, a culture provides standards of proper cognitive, emotional, and behavioral conduct. Culture provides a set of norms and concepts of what is to be expected to exist, why we expect them to exist. Though culture is a product of actual experience, culture is essentially ideological, meaning that it essentially exists in the mind, because culture ultimately is based on the sharing of beliefs and customs and expectations. We receive our culture as a result of, as a part of our social heritage. To the degree that the individual identifies or is at one with this culture, and to the degree to which the members of a culture identify with it, culture is represented in the minds of its people. In other words, we have to recognize deeply that culture cannot exist outside of ourselves. It only can exist in our minds and in our bodies as a people. And therefore, to a great extent, it is ideological more than it is physical, more than it is behavioral, more than it is just ways of dressing. Ultimately, a culture must be represented in the very minds of a people. And it is only through its representation as a mental entity that a people can identify with the culture. A culture is a way of thinking, a way of attending the world, of perceiving the world, of classifying and categorizing the world, of ordering the world, of processing information, and of evaluating the world. When we say then that the Europeans decultured us or distorted our culture, we are also saying then that the Europeans have distorted our modes of attending the world, our modes of experiencing the world, our modes of classifying and categorizing the world, our modes of processing information that comes from the world. So there's no little wonder then that we are having problems in what some people call education, particularly as it is Eurocentrically designed, that our children are perceived as having problems in thinking skills and math skills and science skills and so forth. Because ultimately, you see, culture provides you with a frame for thinking. It provides you with a structure for organizing information, for classifying information, for evaluating information, you see, for processing information. And when you distort a people's culture, then you distort their capacity to appropriately organize information and deal with it. And this is what has happened to us. This is the reason why I say again and again that the problem of education in terms of the problems our children have in schools are not education problems. They are political. They only express themselves as educational problems. The problems our children may have in paying attention, thinking so-called logically, categorizing, classifying, in terms of vocabulary and so forth, are really not academic problems. They are cultural problems, and they are the result of political interactions. Because in transforming our sense of who we are and what we are, and in transforming our culture, so was our thinking and so forth transformed as well. This is why ultimately the educational problems of our people will have to be solved in terms of cultural transformation, not just in terms of educational technique, you see. And this is what the whites try to lay on us. You know, we're going to discover finally that great reading technique. Children can learn almost in any way you teach them. But it's about more than technique. It must be a part of a total cultural structure. And the children must come with a cultural intentionality, because no technique is going to matter if they pay no mind, if they have no interest. You see, if their culture has given them little or no reason for learning what is to be taught, if what they're learning is really not relevant to their situation and their circumstances. And so we have to understand very much how culture itself structures the thought processes. Now, there are some of you who are saying, but there are those of us who knew nothing about African culture and we got all A's in school and so forth and so on. Remember this, though. We got these A's in school and we went through these schools at the price of alienation. As the gentleman who's Carter G. Woodson wrote, about the fact that it took him, 30 years to get over that Eurocentric education? What is he talking about? To a degree, without that African-centeredness, without that African sense of culture, without an African-centered intentionality that determined why he was learning and for what reason he was learning and how he was going to use his learning in the interests of African people, he adopted an alien culture, as many educated blacks have had to do. In adopting the alien culture and adopting the alien outlook and adopting alien values and so forth, they adopted then a thought framework, you see, that allowed so-called what? Success within the European academic system, you see. But the unfortunate thing about it is, once you adopt that structure and that mode and orientation of thinking, you can only work within it. And so you can keep your ability to think abstractly and logically and scientifically only if you work for us as a what? As a scientist. But you cannot take that thought and what? Outside of that structure and use it in your own interest. And this is the dilemma that many of those who so-called succeeded in this system have had to face. You see, I categorize and I classify, but I categorize and I classify in terms of European structures, and I find that I'm only comfortable in what? Working within those structures, and I can only what? Advance those structures. The European system has this economic system set up in such a way that when you try to use this structured kind of thought outside of the system, it won't pay you. Yeah, it will punish you. And often your own group has problems with it, because our group only pays preachers. But it would rarely pay anyone else that tries to operate in its interest. And so you get caught up in two worlds. Socially, culture patterns the ways in which its members relate to each other, interact with each other, perceive each other, and the ways they organize, develop, institutionalize, and apply their human potential in order to adapt to the conditions in which they live to satisfy psychological and social survival needs. Ultimately, as I said again and again, culture is about solving problems. But we're going to learn, as I've indicated before, solving problems in a cultural way, creating power in a cultural way, requires relating to each other in a particular sort of way, implies interacting with each other in a particular sort of way and perceiving each other in a particular sort of way. I've indicated under other circumstances that individuals do not have power. Power is the result of the nature of social relations between people. The way people choose to interact with each other makes power. If you don't believe it, you can go back a few years and see how little white boys could order grown black men around. Were they big enough to beat them? Were they big enough? Did they have enough power to knock them down? No, they didn't. But it was because those little white kids were in a, what, structured framework and had behind them, what, a set of structures and strategies that because white people had chosen to relate to each other in a particular way and interact with each other in a particular way and interact with us in a particular way, even a white child could come out and express power over black folk. But the power was not what? Inherent in the child. But it was inherent in the culture and inherent in how that culture was designed and structured. And it's out of this, and this is what I've told you before about an economic system. An economic system is not the mere existence of money. Economic systems existed prior to money. Money as an instrument of economy has come late in the history of man. And yet we've had economies for hundreds and thousands of years before money came into existence. So ultimately then, an economy must have something to do with the way people choose to cooperate with each other and relate to each other. It is out of this that an economy develops, and it's out of this that power develops, you see. So if you have a culture, the culture is going to provide patterns of relating and interacting. It's these patterns of relating and interacting that permits a people who belong to a culture to solve the problems that confront them. So you see, again, it's just not something is to just indicate that you wear, you see, or the speech that you make, you see. It ultimately has to be about relating in a particular structured sort of way. This is what culture is socially. It is very important to keep in mind that a culture is, to a significant extent, a historical product. Let's talk a second about identity. Identity is the social and personal outcome of the or product of an identification process. According to Bandura, this identification process is a process in which new responses are acquired and existing repertoires of behaviors are modified to some extent as a result of subjection to direct or indirect conditioning procedures. All cultures condition the people that belong to them. All cultures ultimately must have some means of rewarding and punishing behavior. And that's another thing we don't want to face, you know. We want everybody to do right just because it means doing right. And this is what I said earlier when we talk about these conspiracies and these the boule. You're not going to win this game if you don't have a means of neutralizing people and rewarding people, you see, and controlling people. The reason why, as I've often said, the very first thing that we must do if we are to transform our children is to get control of them. Yeah. And we must become their primary rewarders and punishers. We must determine the conditions under which they are socialized if we want to create the kinds of people we need to solve our problems. You are not going to solve your problems giving the control of your children over to other people. And yet we sit around here hoping every day after pushing our children and ourselves into the faces of white folk, into the faces of our enemies, that these people by luck or some means will happen to be the kind of people we need for ourselves. The very point and process of education is to create the people you need for your benefit. And if a culture is going to educate your children, it then will educate them to benefit whom? Itself, not you. Not you. You must bring your children under your own control, and you must be in control of the conditioning process. This is what it's about. If you don't have control of that, then really you're not going to have control of the children. Because identification with a culture, becoming cultured or enculturated, is the result of a culture approving and disapproving, of rewarding and not rewarding, and of sometimes even punishing to ultimately shape the individual in a way that it benefits the culture, and ultimately the individual, him or herself. And this is what identity is about. It's about patterning, the patterning of thoughts, feelings, and actions after other persons who serve as models. You even learn to love. You know, we think that love is something natural, just flows out of us automatically. And yet we have a number of cultures who did not base marriage and these other things, as I've told you before, on romantic love. Mm-mm. Even romantic love is taught and learned. Yeah. Yeah. People are taught how to feel. And we do it all the time. You shouldn't feel that way. You should feel ashamed of yourself for thinking this way, for behaving this way. And we're so unconscious, we don't even recognize it, you see. But we are doing what? We are dictating what? Feelings, thoughts, emotions. What is love? The kids hear it all day long in their records, right? The chill run up my spine. I can't get him out of my mind. I can't eat. I can't sleep. I can't... What is all this is what? Defining what? This is the way you feel if you're in what? If you're in love, you see. And when you got that feeling, then you can do some other things. You know, and you can, you know, make all kind of commitments based on that. But many cultures have built marriage and family and other things on different modes of thinking and behavior other than that. And when you study the history of romantic love, when this type of love approach and this type of approach for building families and so forth first started coming up, there were many people who thought it was just a sign of madness, a sickness, of a precarious basis upon which to build family and culture, you see. But what we're trying to illustrate here is that culture, to a good extent through its conditioning process and other processes, through providing models, helps people to pattern their ways of thinking and feeling and behaving and pattern attitudes. Both the conditioning procedures and contingencies and the models are provided by culture. And of course, we recognize that that's one of our major problems today, that often the models that we want to exhibit before ourselves and our children, and often the means by which we can reward our children's behavior, have not been placed in our hands. That another culture has control of the conditioning mechanism and has control of the models that our by which our children are socialized. We must recognize again then, if we are serious about enculturating our people and enculturating our children, then we must gain the means by which we have to condition their enculturation. We must gain the capacity to reward, to punish, and to reinforce, to model the kind of behavior for our children and ourselves that we need to model. Identity is achieved when, as a result of having undergone the identification process, the individual comes to perceive himself as possessing a distinct and unique character or personality, as being a person in his own right, as being able to answer the questions to his own satisfaction, who am I? What am I, and what do I do with my life? Identity, to the extent that it is a cultural product, and identity is a cultural product, and I want to emphasize this because, you see, in this society, we stress individualism. Mm-hmm. And I try to get across to people all the time that in reality, there's no such thing as an individual. That is a social fiction. It is a type of label we use, but it does not exist in reality. That the individual, the thing that we call an individual, is really a synthesis of social experience, a unique combination of our having interacted with others and having undergone social experiences, and it's our unique way of expressing our social relations and our experiences. But who we are and what we are is the result of social relations. It is not something that is completely what? unique to us and not shared on some level with others. The very fact that you speak a language means that you have a shared identity on some level. If you were completely individual, no one would be able to understand what you were saying. You see? You cannot fit into what? An ordered system and in an ordered society. If you want to imagine to be, you can be a complete individual if you are in space all by yourself. But then what would be the point? It would have no what? No meaning. It would be pointless. Even the concept of individual can only achieve its definition within a social structure. It only has meaning within a social structure and within in terms of relating socially to someone else. Otherwise, it is pointless. It is the social that creates the individual, not the other way around. And yet those who rule over us, you see, could have us think that we can be individuals in and of ourselves and by ourselves without any connection whatsoever to anyone else. And in that way, of course, it can maintain the disunity of our culture and maintain our disunity as a people and ultimately destroy us as a people. So identity is a cultural product. It is the incarnation of a cultural ideology, ecology, and of cultural practice. Identity is culture made flesh. Identity is an instrument for the expression of cultural power. Yes. When an individual identifies with a culture, and remember we said culture is ultimately contained what? In us. Then the individual becomes the what? Instrument of that culture. You see? And this is what I tried to tell you some lectures ago when I talked about manhood, right? When I told you that manhood is a social definition and to be a man is to be socially defined, so that in expressing what it means to be a man, in defending one's manhood, one also does what? Expresses one's culture and defends what? The culture. And in defending the honor of one's manhood, one defends what? The honor of the culture and the honor of the people. And therefore, ultimately, manhood is an expression of the culture, not of a chauvinistic wish on the part of a male. It is not to be defined in isolation and detached from the needs of the culture itself. That when manhood becomes defined, detached from the needs of the culture itself, detached from the needs of people itself, when boys are not trained into men relative to the culture, then these boys will prey upon the culture and destroy the culture. And this is a part of what we have in so-called black-on-black violence. Boys who've been bought into manhood in ways that are detached from African culture and African people, you see, who have not engaged in training in an organic relationship to their Africanness. And therefore, since they are not socially defined, they then become antisocial in their behavior. So ultimately, you see, an identity and a personality is a cultural instrument, and it is through this identity and through this personality that the culture expresses itself and the culture is perpetuated and the culture has an impact on the world and the culture expresses itself as power and defends itself as a culture. But if it defends itself as a culture, it defends its members as people as well. You see? But when people are detached from a culture, they stand alone. And they are undefended. They become vulnerable. And others now destroy them one by one, here and there. And ultimately, a whole of a people are wiped out. Thus, identity, self-concept, are products and instrumentalities as much, if not more, political, economic entities than social, psychological entities. What am I saying here again? We're used to seeing identity as a psychological concept. You see, we talk about my identity as if it belongs to what? Me only. You see, my personality, my this. No, no. Ultimately, we must recognize that our personalities and our identities are, to a good extent, instrumentalities for our culture. But the thing that we want to recognize more so than this is that identity, self-concept, what we call the self and personality, are as much political and economic entities as they are social and psychological entities. In other words, identity, even in a diffused state, is a political economy, an organization of interests, tastes, desires, passions, ideals, motives, values, etc., the pursuit of and the satisfaction of which maintains social power relations, social prerogatives, the integrity of the social, political, economic system, the cultural status quo. What am I saying here? The culture, in inculcating particular values in people, in inculcating particular desires in people, and they don't, see, the culture doesn't inculcate into you the desire for what? Everything, does it? No, it says what? You should desire this and not that. This is desirable, but this is horrible. You know, this you should be interested in, that you don't have to worry about. You see, this you should feel strongly about, that you shouldn't have to worry about. You see, this you should strive to be, these are the ideals we wish you would actualize, this you don't have to try to strive to be. As a matter of fact, you can reject this. This is where you should try to go. These are the goals that we approve of. The others, we don't. Now, when a culture then organizes these values, these ideals, these interests, and so forth, this is a part of our cultural identity, such that when you pursue the satisfaction of these desires, when you pursue the actualization of the cultural ideals, when you pursue the interest that the culture has inculcated in you, what do you do then? By doing this, you maintain what? The culture itself. You see? And many of those things are political, and many are economic. In other words, if the culture tells you that eating a certain food is the right thing to do, and this is what we're about, and eating this food is central and important to our culture, then believe it or not, there's going to be a system of production to do what? Produce what? That food. A system of what? Distribution as well, you see. And a whole system of economic what? Relations, you see. So therefore, this taste, even the taste for food, or certain interests, when you pursue them, maintain a social system and maintain an economic system. And if the structure of that culture, if it's a class culture, a class structure, and if that structure is built on wealth and the accumulation of wealth and the control of the means of production by certain people, your pursuit of those cultural tastes helps to maintain the structure of that culture. Am I getting through?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Am I putting you to sleep?
No.
Hang in with me. Hang in with me, please. Okay. It's very important that we get this in mind. Because without this theory and understanding this, you're going to go blindly into the training of young Moors and the training of your young girls. You're going to take them through the rituals and everything, but they're going to still have European taste and European desire, European things. And they still pursue European ideals and all that, even with their kente on. And despite then, and their superficial behavior, if those tastes and interests and passions and so forth are not also transformed in particular directions, despite their superficial attachment to African culture, they will continue to perpetuate their oppression and maintain the system that they think they're trying to get out from, you see? And this is why you have to understand this theoretical thing, so that you know where you're going when you're talking about educating these children African-centrically, you see. This is why you ultimately are going to have to reject multiculturalism and understand that it's African-centeredness that must be taught to our children, not multiculturalism. Multiculturalism says, all right, everybody's culture is okay, you know, Pollyanna. Oh, you got a culture, I got a culture, all God's children got a culture. So, So, you know, it's all right, you can taste from this one, you can taste from that one, you buy from this one, you buy from that one, which is exactly what black folk are doing right now. You see? And therefore what? Keeping other people's families alive, keeping them out of crime, keeping them well housed, you know, and all the things we're doing because we have not controlled our what? Taste and interest and evolve them in ways that they advance our culture and us as a people. Please get rid of multiculturalism. And it makes you believe every culture is all right. Here you are suffering from European culture, and now you're going to, you know, it's all right. You can't put one down and put the other one up. I mean, Europeans amuse me anyway, talking about their cultural traditions and what great traditions they have brought to the world. The tradition is what you do. Yeah. And it's an insult as an African man to have Europeans talk about their great tradition.
That's right.
You may talk about your philosophy, but that's not your tradition. You may talk about your religion, but that's not your tradition. Or if it is your tradition, then no matter how beautiful it sounds, I must reject it. Because it enslaved me. It oppressed me. And the whole bit, you see. So, and I don't care how sweet it sounds and how logically it is put together or how literate it may be. The ultimate thing is, in what way does it express itself in relationship to me and my people? And if this is the outcome of European tradition, then that tradition must be rejected. You must understand, ladies and gentlemen, what Europeans call great tradition goes hand in hand with their capacity to kill. You know, the Germans, I couldn't understand. You know, we were the literary people and we were the, you know, this and that. But that's one of the reasons why you were able to kill the way you did. Because that was also in there as well. You look at Elijah Muhammad. A misunderstood person. Yeah, misunderstood. Because again, sometimes we're so right-brained, we let our dislike or disapproval of certain of his behaviors overshadow our capacity to see what gifts he brought us as a people. And to come to really understand what this man was about and the greatness of what he created in the Nation of Islam. Yeah. Because we let a series of events get to us so much, we want to throw the baby out with the washwater. You see. But what was he doing? He recognized, too, that cultural identity, religious identity, were as political as they were psychological, were as economical as they were psychological. You see? And he recognized then that he had to also change the taste of black people and change their what? Interest as well. Their emotions and their what? Feelings as well. And a part of that change was projection of the white man as demon mythology, which was very functional and real. But very functional. See, I've told you, a lot of people think, oh, well, that wasn't the truth. This wasn't the point. It wasn't the point. It amazes me now. You know, someone mentioned the Tuskegee experiments. These whites are going to tell all the truth now. Now that they got the what? The world, what? Wrapped up. But in wrapping it up, they projected the what? The myth. Because the myth, the major function of the myth is to organize people, to organize a people's perception of themselves to give them a sense of destiny and commonality, to arrange their social relations in such a way so that they could achieve particular points and particular ends. And it's not that they didn't know that the Egyptians might have been African. It was in their literature. That's a lot of where we got it from, isn't it? But at the point where a mythology of Africans as being uncultured served to organize them and create a unity among themselves and serve